This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
In astrophysics, like Paul is turning to cancer, just think about astrobiology. If you're looking for the origins of life in galaxies, in space, in the solar system, then you are necessarily looking at the ways in which life manifests, how it may start. And next thing, you're having a conversation about how life might actually go a bit wrong by having accelerations of certain cell growths and so forth. So it does make a lot of sense. Given that background, what Paul is going to talk about today is really the ways in which that work has developed to a very exciting stage. So would you please welcome Paul Davis from the State University of Arizona.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I think we omitted the part about the Aboriginal community, but I guess people have heard that a few times now. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be back here at the University of Adelaide, where I worked for about 10 years in the 1990s. And as Robin has indicated, I'm going to be talking about something completely different. For those of you who have followed aspects of my career, you'll know that primarily I'm a theoretical physicist and cosmologist, and have turned in more recent years to the subject of astrobiology. What's that? It means searching for life elsewhere in the universe and trying to understand how life got going here on Earth. And I'm going to tell you the story in a moment about how I came to be caught up in cancer research. I should say right at the outset that cancer touches every family on the planet. It's one of the most intensively studied phenomena in biology, and yet it's one of the least well understood. And so my title, What is Cancer and How Can We Manage It, is very well chosen, because in spite of the many, many years and thousands of researchers and millions of published research papers, there's no consensus on what this phenomenon we call cancer actually is. And the word manage is also very carefully chosen, because for reasons I will come to in a moment. But let me first start with a bit of history. Back in 1971, so more than 40 years ago, President Richard Nixon declared war on cancer. I'm told he never actually used that terminology, but it's a metaphor that has persisted. People always talk about battling with cancer and the war on cancer. And so we've had more than 40 years, and the question is, how are we getting on? Well, first of all, let me turn to the financial aspect. The cost of cancer research is really quite staggering. The United States spends $5 billion a year of taxpayer money, and then there's charitable money on top of that. And just to put that in perspective, that's more than the US government spends on space exploration. So people who say we're wasting all this money in space, we spend it on cancer research, it's a comparable figure. And the total price tag over the duration of the war on cancer is about $100 billion. Now, this is just US. There will be comparable figures, say, for Europe and other aspects of other parts of the world. The costs of cancer are not just in the research, but cancer healthcare. Healthcare figures are very hard to interpret because they include all sorts of hidden costs. So I don't propose to do that, though I saw the figure of €162 billion per year for Europe as the cost of cancer care and cancer management. But the one thing that it's easy to put a price tag on is the cost of cancer drugs. And so a course of anti-cancer drugs might typically be around $100,000. These are all US figures. I apologize for that. That's just what I've been provided with by the National Cancer Institute. It's very easy to see that as people live longer, more people get cancer, cancer incidence is rising remorselessly, that the cost of treatment, just drugs alone, is set to bankrupt the US economy. And so this, just in economic terms, is really stupendous. Now, you might be wondering, what are we getting for all this money? Well, here are some chilling statistics. This is the death rates in the United States, and what it's doing is comparing some major killer diseases like heart disease, pneumonia and influenza, for example, all of which, between 1950 and 2004, all of which have come down really quite dramatically. So infectious diseases were on top of those. Of course, they're not eliminated, but huge progress. And when Nixon signed that law back in 1971, he said we will conquer cancer in 5 years. So the expectation was that this would be the next thing to fall to the miracles of modern medical research. But look at what has actually happened. A slight improvement, but overall nothing very dramatic at all. There are lots of ways you can cut these figures. People will talk about death rates, they talk about survival rates. Whichever way you look at it, the figures are overall gloomy. Now, that conceals the fact that there are some limited successes in extending life expectancy, and in the case of childhood leukemia, quite spectacular advances. Some cancers are killing less people now, some are killing more people. So it all pretty much averages out. There's been progress, but it's very slow, in fact, painfully slow. And so when you find something so intensively studied as cancer over such a long period of time, with such huge resources poured into it and very little progress, it makes you wonder if perhaps progress is slow because we're thinking about the problem the wrong way. In other words, instead of saying we're not spending enough money, we can solve this problem if we throw enough money at it, that tends to be the attitude, at least in the United States, maybe we're not thinking right. Maybe it's not a question of money, it's a question of rethinking the problem from the ground up. And the reason that I came to be involved is entirely due to a phone call from this lady here, Anna Barker. At the time, she was deputy director of the National Cancer Institute. It was a phone call out of the blue. She said, "You don't know me, but I've noticed the center that you've established at Arizona State University, the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science, where you consider foundational questions across all of the sciences. You go right back to basics and ask, what are the hidden assumptions we're making? How can we reconceptualize this problem? How can we make progress?" And she said, "You physicists seem to be really good at solving problems because you can figure out what's going on inside atoms, you know what's happening at the edge of the universe, you've got all this clever stuff. Can you help with cancer?" Well, what was I to say? Sure, we can help out. But I said, "But unfortunately, I think you're talking to the wrong person. I know nothing about cancer." And she said, "That's perfect." And that's how it all began. I should mention as a postscript that this lady is now working as a colleague of mine at Arizona State University, though not primarily on the cancer research. That would be considered corruption. But nevertheless, she's now one of my colleagues. So this is a story that she likes to tell and I like to tell, and we seem to have the same version of it. So I came into it cold, and the whole idea was to bring a fresh perspective to a very deep and complex set of problems. And she asked me to give the keynote opening address at the initial precursory workshop that preceded the funding program, and I just sort of reeled off a few things. But what I said was that one reason to bring in physicists into this field is that they can ask really stupid questions, seemingly without embarrassment. And sometimes those really stupid questions, like, "Explain to me how that works, and supposing you ran it backwards, and would it matter if you turn the temperature up a bit?" All these sorts of questions, cancer biologists often say, "Oh, well, nobody's ever asked that," or "That's a very good question," or mostly, "Well, nobody knows." And I always figure if you get a lot of clever people in a room, the sum total of what everybody doesn't know is what's really interesting, because that's where progress is likely to be made. That's the opposite approach. Normally you get people together and you say, "Let's pool our knowledge." Well, I'm after pooling ignorance, because it's in the gaps of ignorance that we're likely to make progress. Anyway, the upshot was that the National Cancer Institute, in an extraordinary, far-sighted and generous move, decided to create 12 centres for physical science and oncology, this ungainly acronym, PSOC, and here they are, scattered around the country, and that's us. And it won't surprise you to learn that I'm running the show at ASU, running our particular physical science and oncology centre. And the whole plan is that each of these centres has a physical scientist, not necessarily a physicist, might be an engineer, nanotechnologist, chemist, but a physical scientist twinned with either a cancer biologist or an oncologist. So we really make an effort to talk to each other. This is the shape of our setup. We work in collaboration with the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale and the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Centre in Seattle. And so the lineup of talent here is that we've got 6 clinical oncologists or cancer biologists, 5 physicists, physical chemists, an astrobiologist, 3 engineers or nanotechnologists, 1 education outreach person, that's my wife Pauline sitting there, and that's allowed apparently in the United States. It's not nepotism, I was surprised. We have about 15 mainly graduate students working in this. And if you want more information, because I'm just giving you the bare bones of this, visit our website, which Pauline created and manages. It's packed full of information. So let me come on to what my own contribution is, apart from administering this monster. My advice to anybody here is never deal with the US government, and the troubles of the last couple of weeks are only minor in comparison with all the things we had to put up with in terms of reporting and accounting and never knowing what our budget is. It's a real challenge just to do that. And also, never run an interdisciplinary research group. It's like herding cats. And so there's a challenge both looking up to Washington and looking down to my colleagues, and particularly with their lab work, because I'm a theoretical physicist, so for me all my work is up here, but for them it's in test tubes and they don't let me near them, and if I go into the lab I have to promise not to touch anything. But I'm sort of responsible for the whole show. But in addition to running it, I've tried to make a real contribution to this subject by doing what I think all good physicists should do when they're faced with a really knotty problem, is you go right back to basics. You ask the most fundamental questions of all, and then you try to build up a conceptual framework. There's no way I can compete with mainstream cancer researchers on their home turf. That would be ridiculous. The best I can do is bring a lifetime of experience across several sciences and survey the scientific landscape and spot what I think are significant facts, almost all of which will be known to somebody in the cancer community, and connect the dots in perhaps a novel way. So I'm trying to change the culture of thinking, the culture of research in cancer biology. I can't obviously get onto their turf and overtake them. So it's a matter really of affecting a change in thinking. And so I've tried to develop a theory of cancer in the sense of, you might think after all this time there would be a well-defined theory of cancer, that we would understand what it is. Not at all. And so I think we have to position cancer in the great sweep of the story of life on Earth. So here it is. The questions: what is cancer? Most people take it for granted. Well, it's a disease to be cured. What is cancer? Why does it exist in the first place? And how does it fit into the great story of life? The take-home message is one that's both good news and bad news. I don't think cancer is a disease to be cured. I think it's a condition or a phenomenon to be managed. I think we can manage it, but the lure of the cure, I think, has distracted a lot of research. People want a pill to make it go away. I don't think there will ever be a general purpose pill to do that. Cancer is not that sort of thing. It's not like an infectious disease. So I often say cancer's a bit like aging. I go around the world and everywhere I go, there's aging. I see it everywhere. People are dying of it in every country I visited. There seems to be nothing we can do to hold it back. Of course, we can't stop aging, but we can mitigate its effects. We can have huge effect on quality of life and life extension. And this has happened in Australia and elsewhere. And cancer is the same. It's not something that we should really think about curing. We should think about preventing it and managing it. And I think we could do a lot better at the management than we do at the moment. What is cancer? It's a very simple story. People say it's a complex disease, but actually it's a very predictable disease. What happens is cells start to proliferate uncontrollably in a particular organ, and then they spread around the body, that's called metastasis, colonize other organs, and the outcome is usually bad. 90% of fatalities from cancer are not caused by the primary tumor, but by this dissemination. And you might think that, seeing as that's so familiar, millions and millions of people every year are diagnosed with cancer, and it follows this pattern. You might think that physiologists would have a pretty good idea, or physicians would have a pretty good idea of what's going on, but they really don't. So a lot of details, a lot of facts, but no real understanding of what this phenomenon is and why it exists. So just to whiz through this, because we've got very little time, this is just saying in pictures what I said in words, a primary tumour in a particular organ. There's a cascade of events, all of which requires cancer cells to acquire various functions that they didn't have at the outset, sometimes called modalities. Gain of function and loss of function are an important part of the cancer story. So the cells transform as they go through this journey, metaphorical and literal, because what happens is the cells will leave the primary tumour, often in procession. They will get into the bloodstream, spread around in this raging torrent, get out of the bloodstream, called extravasation, enter a remote organ and make a home there, colonize it. There are many steps in that process. The thinking behind bringing physical scientists in is that, in addition to cancer cells responding to various sorts of chemical signals and various types of genetic information processing, they're also physical objects. They're little things. With physical properties like a size, a shape, they undergo shear stresses, and they're all sorts of, they have elastic properties. All sorts of physical things have to happen to cancer cells and will change with cancer cells. If we understood those physical changes, gives us a handle to control them. There are even electrical changes. I'll touch on that very briefly later. Let me take some significant facts, often overlooked in cancer biology. Cancer doesn't actually invent anything new. All it does is accesses or appropriates existing modalities, that is, biological function, which is already there in the organism, but it's deployed in an abnormal way. And it's not a matter of just deploying one particular functionality, but a whole suite of functions co-present in the same collection of cells, often called a neoplasm, new cells, a community of cells. A lot of people think that cancer is like rogue cells running amok, but it's more organized than that. It's almost like a loosely cooperative multicellular organism. I'll come back to that because it's part of what I'm trying to develop in the theory. Now, cancer is characterized by a number of hallmarks. I don't have time to go through them all. I'll just mention two or three which are well known. One is its proliferative ability. I've already said that. It multiplies uncontrollably. The other is its ability to evade programmed cell death. Multicellular organisms, based on a contract that was signed about 1.5 billion years ago between individual cells, in which the immortality of the unicellular world, where the only imperative is replicate, 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 was subordinated to the agenda of the collective. And so in a multicellular organism, most cells eventually die. Most cells are called somatic cells, the skin cells and kidney and liver and so on. They get a certain number of replication events and then they die. It's programmed cell death. And that trade-off, well, the germ line, the germ cells, the eggs and sperm, carry the immortality into the next generation. So they've been the cells of our body have outsourced that function to these sex cells. They carry into the next generation, and they pay the price by undergoing this process called apoptosis or programmed cell death. Cancer disables the apoptotic pathways, and a number of other things as well. But the point I want to try and get across is that these functions of cancer cells are co-present, several of these properties co-present in the same population of cells, sometimes in the same cells. And when I first learned about this, I thought, well, everything you're told about cancer is that it's something's gone wrong. It seems to me that the best way of thinking about It's the bottle half full, half empty. The best way of thinking about it is really not so much these are cells that have gone wrong, but cells that are doing something very efficient. They're going right as far as their agenda is concerned. They're very good at what they do. In other words, instead of thinking of cancer as an aberration, I rather prefer to think of it as unleashing a potential, which is there all the time, a modality that I'm daring enough to call pre-programmed. And this raises the hackles of a lot of cancer researchers. But I think that cancer occurs because the suite of modalities which cancer needs to fulfill its agenda is pre-programmed into pretty much all the cells in your body at the outset. So I've got a little metaphor that I'll show you in a moment. The standard theory of cancer is that it results from the accumulation of genetic damage, maybe from radiation or carcinogens or just aging, just defects in the replicative machinery. And this accumulates over a period of time and then reaches a sort of threshold at which the cell then goes berserk. But the important point is that cancer isn't something, apart from the Tasmanian devil, as I'm sure Robin knows about, isn't something you catch. It's something that develops de novo inside your body. So it's reinvented from the bottom up each time. And that's the standard theory. I'm going to criticize that. So the standard theory is that cancer is cells gone wrong, but gone wrong in the same way in all individuals and in other species as well. Whereas the theory that I'm trying to develop, and I neglected to say right at the outset, that everything that I'm talking about is developed in collaboration with Charlie Lineweaver at the Australian National University. Charlie, like me, is a cosmologist and theoretical physicist with an interest in astrobiology and now turned into sort of amateur cancer researcher. And we've been collaborating on this together with some postdocs and students at Arizona State University. So the theory that we're proposing is that cancer is actually a pre-programmed ancient like subroutine, if you'll permit me to use this computer analogy, a subroutine that's preloaded into cells, and that genetic genomic accidents may trigger the cancer subroutine, but they're not primarily the cause of it. In other words, it's an accident waiting to happen. There's certainly genomic instability in cancer. If you sequence cancer cells, they're very heterogeneous genomically. They've accumulated lots of mutations. But the assumption is usually that the mutations are causing the cancer. We think the cancer is a response to a stressful environment and that the mutations are largely collateral damage. That is, they are incidental to the cancer story. It's the cancer causes the mutations, not the other way around. That's the theory anyway. So this is just a diagram, makes the same point. The standard theory called the somatic mutation theory, well, I've called it dogma to be provocative, is a bottom-up theory. Something goes wrong at the molecular level, at the DNA level, genetic accidents accumulate, they give rise to cancer, and that destabilizes the cells, and there's further mutations, and it becomes I was going to say a virtuous circle, but you know whatever the opposite of that is, unvirtuous circle. So we think that is probably not the way to think about it, but that the we have a sort of top-down theory that we think that cancer is a response to a stressed environment. Now, I must say at the outset, when I use that word stress, everybody thinks, oh, yes, you know, I'm always rushing around, I feel stressed, I'm going to get cancer. It's not the way that scientists mean when they use the word stress. A stressed environment or a bad environment might be one in which the pressure is elevated or the pH has changed or there may be a drop in oxygen tension. So what I mean is biologically stressed, not psychologically stressed. And that is leading to the cancer, and the mutations are part of the cancer phenotype is what I'm going to use that expression. A phenotype is really the expression. What is a phenotype? Don't have the actual Wikipedia definition at my fingertips, but the genotype is the genetic information. The phenotype is its expression in the actual physical organism. So I've said that I have an analogy. Here it is. Think of cancer as like a genie in a bottle, an accident, if you like, waiting to happen. All cells have the potential to become cancer cells, but they're sitting in there, and mostly they don't cause any trouble. And I have to say that even when they cross the line and become cancer cells, in a healthy tissue environment, they are restrained. In other words, there are many regulatory mechanisms which in a healthy organism prevent tumours from forming. But a variety of things can let the genie out of the bottle, and then when the genie has escaped, we are claiming that that genie executes the program or the subroutine with rather ruthless efficiency. So the genie is not something gone wrong. The genie is a breakdown of the regulatory apparatus that prevents the genie from enacting its program. Now, in a nutshell, what I think is not wrong, but a distraction of modern cancer research is there's a huge amount of effort and money being spent picking over the shapes of the shards of glass that have released the genie in the hope that elusive patterns will emerge. And people will say, ah, we've noticed that in this cancer, you know, this age and that age has got a certain angle and so on. Of course, I'm using a metaphor. But the point is that they're looking for clues in the damage, in the shattered regulatory apparatus that has released the real culprit, which is the genie. So I think they're concentrating on the wrong target. There are many ways you can shatter a bottle, many ways of letting the genie out, but once the genie is out, its own performance will be really rather predictable. So I'm galloping through this because I need to get on a plane, basically. It's a striking fact that if you take a cancer cell and put it in a normal tissue environment, it usually doesn't progress. In other words, the microenvironment of the cell acts to control the destiny of that cell. You can really take quite grotesque cancer cells, that is very badly distorted cells, both genetically and physically distorted cells, and they will still behave more or less normally. They won't cause a trouble anyway in a normal tissue environment. If you put enough of them together, however, they sort of take over, and then, in fact, they appropriate or recruit healthy cells in their vicinity. So it really is a case of if you can't beat them, join them. And I sometimes, like it goes down well in America, say, well, it's a little bit like the early European settlers. They came over in their boats and then they built forts on the east coast of the United States, and they had a rough time and they kept their heads down and they were confined. And then they bribed a few of the local Indians and recruited them to the cause, and then they reached a sort of critical mass, and then they burst out and took over the country. Well, it's a little bit like that. The cancer will spread around the body, and it will colonize these organs, but very often these microtumors make little progress, and they just remain dormant, sometimes for years, sometimes forever. And so this makes it for a confused picture, because it's wrong to think that people either have cancer or don't have cancer. It's not like, well, you know, I've caught the flu, or I haven't caught the flu. It's not one of those open and shut things. As the body ages, all sorts of cells undergo all sorts of changes down this pathway, and the vast majority of these cells never present clinical symptoms. And so what we would like to understand is under what circumstances do they become problematic, and can we then manipulate the physical parameters, is my dream as a physicist, manipulate the physical parameters to prevent that dissemination, spread, and explosion out of the niche that they've colonized. I say physical spread because the way in which cancer is treated at the moment is largely by surgery and drugs, and the drugs are really a chemical attack on those cells, whereas I have this idea that we need to look to the physical environment. What is that? I've already mentioned. It could be things like temperature, oxygen tension, pressure, shear stresses, electric fields. There's only a handful of these things. These parameters matter, and I'm going to show you why. For example, we have an interesting lady who works at Arizona State University, Cheryl Nickerson, and NASA pays her to send Salmonella into orbit. And you might think, well, why are they doing that? And as you probably know, for every, I think we've got about 100 billion cells in our body, but we have a trillion parasites, often called the microbiome or the microflora or microbiota, which are an essential part of healthy living. So our guts are full of bacteria and archaea, our skin, our lungs. They're crawling all over us. It's a yucky thought, but they really fulfill an important function. And the point is, if you go into orbit, say with some salmonella in your gut, could it be that you don't fare so well in zero-G than you would down here on the ground? And sure enough, the gene expression of these microorganisms will change in low-gravity environment. So in other words, bacteria have the ability to be able to sense the physical forces in their microenvironment. Sometimes this is a phenomenon called mechanotransduction. Mechanical forces can be transduced into changes in gene expression. So the way in which a cell or even an organism behaves, its phenotype, its gene expression, can depend on the physical forces acting in its environment. This is one example, it's a very striking one. Here's another one that I really like, the work of Michael Levin at Tufts University. He measures the electric fields inside cells. He likes particularly these little worms called planaria, and he does these diabolic experiments with these worms. These are favourites among school children because you can chop them up and they regenerate. So if you chop a planarium in two, the head grows a tail, the tail grows a head, and you've got two of them, and that's great fun. But it turns out that they have an electric polarity, both within the organism as a whole and within cells. So the secret electric life of cells is a really fascinating subject that's not really been much studied. But with various clever dyes, you can actually measure electric fields in and around cells. So there are few, when you have a wound, there's electric fields around that wound. If you have limb regeneration, for example, in salamanders, there's a whole electric story going on. So electric fields are part of what are biologists call morphogens, but they're normally thinking of chemicals, but electric fields also play a role in helping shape the phenotype. And the extraordinary thing is that if you manipulate these electric fields, what you can do is you can grow two-headed planaria like that and two-tailed planaria. And I find it endlessly fascinating when I asked Michael Levin, were these ones really stupid compared to those, he said, well, no, it didn't seem to make too much difference. But the point is, the key point is, they all have the same DNA, you see, but clearly their phenotypes are different, so the gene expression has depended on their, in this case, electrical circumstances. So if we're right then that there is a cancer subroutine lurking inside all cells, if cells come preloaded with it, why is that? Why hasn't evolution eliminated it? And the famous dictum of Dobzhansky, that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, is our guide here. Because Charlie and I thought, well, what is going on here with this cancer stuff? How can we make sense of it? And the first thing we noted was the fact that, of course, cancer is not restricted to human beings. It's pretty much pervasive across the multicellular world. All mammals, fish, with the exception of the naked mole rat, but I'm not going to get into that. All mammals, fish, birds, reptiles, and even plants have cancer or cancer-like phenomena. So this is obviously something that is deeply rooted in the evolutionary sense. It will go back at least to the point of common ancestry of these organisms, and that's hundreds of millions of years. But we think because cancer has to do with multicellularity, we think it goes back to the dawn of multicellularity, which was about 1.5 billion years ago. I've already said unicellular life just wants to replicate. Multicellular life is a contract outsourcing the immortality to the germ cells. Apoptosis is the price that the somatic cells pay. And cancer is a breakdown of that contract. Somatic cells, like a liver cell or a lung cell, say, nope, I'm opting out. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to make a bid for immortality, and to hell with that contract. And all of the policing or the regulatory mechanisms are ignored or evaded or disabled. Apoptosis is switched off. Various other mechanisms, all at once, all those modalities are either disabled or other modalities are switched on. And so it's a very clever and systematic response. It's a breakdown of that contract. I first got to think about this because of reading this paper well, this is a report of the paper in Nature about 3 years ago about sequencing of the genome of a sponge, actually an Australian sponge found in Queensland, which has identifiable tumour suppressor genes. So even a sponge, even something that primitive, needs to worry about cancer. That has a lineage going back about 600 million years. So you have to go back a long way before humans and sponges intersect. But nevertheless, cancer is a problem going all the way back. Now, you might think, well, evolution's had then hundreds of millions, if not longer, of years to get rid of cancer because of its killing organisms. Why have we still got it? Why is it still around? And the answer, as always in biology, is it's a trade-off. If something that is bad for you is still there, in spite of evolution, it must mean that it's also fulfilling a useful function. What is the useful function of cancer? The answer is embryogenesis. The development of the embryo involves the upregulation or the expression of key genes which are reawakened in cancer. I should say, just in passing, it's not just embryogenesis. Wound healing and the immune system are also aspects or modalities, remember, that the cancer is appropriating in an inappropriate context. In other words, cancer is using things that healthy organisms need, like developing embryos, wound healing, and the immune system, and it's using them for its own purposes. This has been known for many years. This is a paper from 1987, oncogenes in development. So oncogenes are genes which are implicated in cancer. So a long list of them, and these genes are active in embryogenesis. The work of Isaac Kohani at Harvard MIT, a very good article in Scientific American, he's quite explicit that he's identified genes that are upregulated, switched on in most cancers, and these are genes which are active in early development. So there's really no mystery about this, but when I discuss it with my oncology colleagues and my cancer biology colleagues, they'll say, well, yes, I think we know that. You know, so what? What's new? What's new, I think, is that it's clearly a deeply significant clue to about how cancer comes to exist and what it is, the fact that it is reawakening genes which are active in early stage embryogenesis and normally silenced thereafter. So it's just a question of not damaging the genes, but switching back on genes that should be left silent. Now, genetic damage can lead to that. So in other words, if a tumour suppressor gene or a regulatory mechanism is arbitrarily damaged, just smashed in some way, then it may simply release the potential for the genie to do its stuff, in this case, expressing genes which should remain silent except during embryogenesis. So it could have a trigger, could be a mutational trigger, but the actual deployment of those modalities is something which is very systematic, very organized, and really quite frightening in terms of its efficiency. So our hypothesis then is that cells become deregulated for one reason or another due to stress or accident, and they're defaulting back to an ancestral pathway. And the reason I say ancestral is because the basic body plans of human beings are pretty much the same as the basic body plans of dogs or fish. You can look at the early stage embryo and they all look more or less the same in the early stages, and then the differences develop later. So the very early part of embryo development recapitulates the common origin of these multicellular organisms. So these are, so to speak, the ancient genes. I always get ticked off by my biology colleagues that all genes are ancient. You know, they've all come from somewhere with a trail that goes back 3.5 billion years. But in some sense, some genes are widespread and conserved and have remained largely unchanged for hundreds of millions of years. I would call those the ancient genes or the old genes. And the genes that lay down the basic body plan had better be like that. So the ancient genes are also the ones that are active in early stage embryogenesis. So this is, we like to say, an atavistic theory of cancer. It is, or a throwback theory of cancer. We're saying that cancer is recapitulating not only early multicellular life, but early embryogenesis as well. We go beyond that, so no point in having a theory if it can't be tested. We think that as cancer progresses, say, from the first glimmerings of dysplasia in a cell of changes right up to the full-blown disseminated malignant metastatic disease, that it's like running the arrow of evolutionary time backwards at high speed. And here we see three arrows of time. We see the evolutionary arrow over hundreds of millions or billions of years. Then there's the developmental arrow, the ontogeny arrow, over 9 months in the case of humans. And then we have the carcinogenesis arrow runs the other way over a period of weeks, months, maybe a few years. So it's like running that backwards. So that's a very specific prediction, and we're trying to test it by looking at phylogenetic data across many species, trying to date the genes and look at the genes which are active and implicated in cancer to see if these are really the ancient genes, and also to test whether, as cancer progresses, whether there is a change in the depth on the phylogenetic tree of the genes that are causing the problems. I mentioned atavisms. You may know an atavism is when an organism is born with some sort of ancestral trait. In the case of the dolphin, four fins instead of two. There are many known examples of this even with humans. Humans born with tails, for example. This sort of thing can happen. It gives a clue, because what it means is that in spite of the fact we've divested ourselves of those features maybe tens of millions of years ago, the information to create them is still in our genomes. It's just that the pathways to switch them on are hidden and normally silenced. So in other words, we have a lot of atavistic features already. It's well known in biology. Atavistic features can be retained. They'll be retained for a function, you can be sure. And we think cancer is a very ancient type of atavism in that sense. Another analogy I like to use is a computer that starts up in safe mode. So if you drop your computer, you see this sort of horrible screen and you think, oh dear, got trouble now. Or it may be a software glitch. You've loaded some latest version of something from Java or something and it all goes wrong and you get safe mode. Safe mode is simply a way of running the core functionality of a computer with a limited set of capabilities, and it's enough to keep the thing going. I see cancer as a bit like that. Cancer, by being a throwback, is divesting itself of a lot of modern functionality, which is unnecessary to run the core functionality. The inner core, the genie, is that inner core of largely undamaged genes and regulatory pathways. Not just genes, not just a package of genes, more complicated than that, but it's a core functionality which it runs. And the reason that you see all of this mutational damage is because the genes that mutate are simply abandoned, because there's no point in expending resources in all the editing and error correction functions for those genes that are not part of that core functionality. So there's another metaphor. So what I've done, I want to pull this to a conclusion, built bridges between cancer biology, developmental biology, and evolutionary biology, and astrobiology, as Robin mentioned, important part. These are subject areas where people don't normally talk to each other. What we do at Arizona State University is we bring them together. We have brainstorming workshops where we mix up people from these different disciplines and try to drill right down to the fundamentals so we can come to understand cancer in new ways. This next slide is a specific prediction testing our theory. I've already said this about when the genes are overexpressed or underexpressed and that this should correlate with the age. I can't show you the data. We have an undergraduate called Adam, appropriately enough, who's going back on the phylogenetic tree, and there's vast databases across species, and he's trying to make sense of the cancer database, and he's doing great work trying to correlate these two, but it's work in progress. I'm going to mention one thing that I threw into the mix on opening night, which is the work of Otto Warburg, who back in the 1920s thought that cancer was less to do with genes and more to do with metabolism, the way in which cells utilize, for example, sugar, and how they use oxygen to produce energy. I'm not going to go into the details, partly because I don't understand the details, but he felt that some sort of error or dysregulation of this type of respiration was the main hallmark of cancer. And it's certainly the case that if healthy and cancer cells are subjected to a reduced oxygen environment, a hypoxic is the term, hypoxic environment, they can do metabolism another way. They can do something called the fermentation or glycolysis, and they make their energy that way. Cancer cells prefer that way of doing it, whereas healthy cells, once you restore the oxygen, they go back to the oxygenic method. So we feel that a prediction of our theory, and just generally as a prediction, that we think that if cancer is a throwback to an earlier form of life, its most comfortable environment is an early environment. And when you look back at the oxygen levels on Earth, it underwent two great surges. One was about 2 billion years ago, the first great oxygenation event, and the next one was about between 600 and 800 million years ago. And multicellularity evolved in that plateau in between when oxygen levels were much less than they are now. In other words, multicellular life dates back from a hypoxic world. Embryos are hypoxic. Tumors are hypoxic. We think there's clearly a clue in that. What are we going to do in terms of treatment? It's all very well having a theory, but does it make a difference in the clinic? We think so. There's a general principle, which is that when you deal with something as efficient as cancer, it pays not to target the strengths, because it usually wins in the end. For example, the one strength is proliferative ability. Most cancer drugs target that proliferative ability, but the cancer usually wins. We think you should target the weaknesses, because we think that gains of function are really regaining deep, ancient, and therefore very well-protected functions. Proliferative ability is the default state of cells. You go for that. You're going for something that's been around 3.5 billion years. Life has learned a lot of tricks in that time about how to evade threats that threaten that. On the other hand, cancer can't have it both ways. If it's a reversion to an earlier or ancestral phenotype, then it's going to divest itself of some modern functionality. For example, I've mentioned oxygen. It's going to be uncomfortable in a normal oxygen environment. So what you need to do to control cancer, not cure it, not even eliminate it, but just control it, slow it down, is create an environment that targets the weaknesses of cancer, that makes the cancer cells feel more uncomfortable than the healthy cells. In practice, this is just one example. One way of doing this, I've mentioned about the oxygen story. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy is one way of flooding the tissues with oxygen. Glucose restriction. Cancer loves oxygen. Cancer loves sugar, hates oxygen. So you give it lots of oxygen and very little sugar. And that might mean starvation or at least dietary restriction. And the pH, we don't need to worry about that here. So that is one way of proceeding. Paper just out last month, the ketogenic diet, which is basically a low-sugar diet, and hyperbaric oxygen therapy prolongs survival in mice. There's an awful lot of dead mice out there, I have to say, in the history of cancer research. Of course, just because it works in mice doesn't mean it'll work in humans. But we're having a workshop next month with the leading advocates of people who think cancer is a metabolic disease, just like Otto Warburg suggested decades ago. And we'll see what clinical evidence they have to present that this could be a therapeutic advantage. The great advantage of this, which is basically turn up the oxygen, change the diet, is you don't need clinical trials. People use hyperbaric oxygen therapy for all sorts of other reasons. So you don't have to go through this long, expensive business as you do with drugs that take decades, cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and mostly don't work when you're finished. So using physical means to control cancer is going to translate into much more rapid clinical advantage. I want to end by being even more provocative, because there's one other aspect I want to mention here. You'll probably get up and walk out of the stage. One of the so-called modern functionalities that organisms have, like us, is an adaptive immune system. It's very clever, works very well. And so if we get a germ inside us, it gets attacked by the immune system, which can adapt and zap it. But if cancer, if we're right, cancer is a reversion. The adaptive immune system evolved about 400 million years ago. And so advanced cancer should decouple from that adaptive immune system. That's our prediction. It would decouple from it. And therefore, the adaptive immune system's not talking to the cancer's not talking to the immune system. You'll find all this in textbooks. You will be told that cancer evades or hides from the immune system. So that's known. It does do that. But what we think is that makes the cancer vulnerable to, as it were, modern infections, that is, infections in the last 400 million years. So cancer is more likely to suffer from infections, bacterial, viral infections, than healthy cells. I didn't know about this because we were predicting that you should deliberately infect people with virulent microorganisms in order to attack the cancer, having vaccinated them first. So you don't want to kill them with smallpox, for example, but having given them a vaccination in the first place. And then my attention was drawn only recently when I was giving a lecture on this stuff in London to the work of William Coley. I'm going to finish with this story. About 100 years ago, standard of care for people treating cancer was to use some cocktail of infection that Coley had prepared. He was struck by the fact that in the early part of the 19th century, there were many, many cases of spontaneous remission from cancer in patients who'd had post-operative infection. And that he didn't see many cases around about the turn of the 20th century. And he put that down to the use of sterilized instruments that we would consider it barbaric to remove a tumor with a rusty razor blade or something. But that's what they used to do in the past. And so he thought that the infection might make the cancer go away, and so deliberately infected them. Now, of course, that was then considered barbaric, a bit like using leeches, and it sort of dropped out of consciousness. But the truth is that there are many, many case studies where people, including today, where people get infected, the cancer goes away. Now, the standard explanation for that is the exact opposite of what we're saying. The standard explanation is you get an infection, the immune system is boosted, and that the immune system goes after the cancer as well as the infection. We think it's the exact opposite. We think that the cancer isn't talking to the immune system, and the cancer is not killed by a boosted immune system. It's killed by the disease. The disease kills the cancer. The immune system saves the patient. So we think it's around that way. So that's a prediction of our theory. We're finding it very hard to get anybody to actually do it. But they're always the mice, of course. In case you want the conclusions, and I'll leave this slide up, because we are pressed for time. I know that there'll be questions. I'm going to leave it up there. You can read that for yourselves and sit down and take questions. Thank you.
Well done, Paul. You might like to know that at the University of Newcastle, New South Wales, there are people who are working on common cold virus, and of course that renews itself all the time, injected into tumours, which then die. Mind you, the work is in progress at the moment, so it's probably worth checking now. I haven't heard from them for at least a year, but we have one question over there, please. You'll probably need a mic. Will you stand up over there?
Yeah. And should all this be successful and you kill cancers which are operating in a way that cells used to operate before multicellular organisms, are you going to destroy the microbiome that supports our life as part of our bodies?
Cancer, remember, is not a communicable disease, so everything that goes on, both in the cancer and in the treatment, is confined to one organism. If you're saying, are you going to play havoc with the patient's individual microbiome, I would think that any sort of treatment is likely to do that. But there's a flip side to that, changing your gut microbiome seems to me, and I think it's good evidence, is clearly a cancer risk, because just very, very quickly, the two reasons. One is that I think it can create hypoxic pockets in the gut, but the other is that inflammation and cancer go hand in hand. Inflammation means that the immune system is in overdrive. It means that there's the organs become leaky. That is, that the communication between the bloodstream and the organ is opened up, and that enables cancer cells to get in there and so on. So any sort of treatment is going to carry the risks that you upset something. And so, of course, you'd have to be a trade-off. But there's no direct competition between the cancer cells, these are eukaryotic cells, and the microbiota I've been talking about, which are prokaryotic, they're bacteria or archaea.
And that's why poo transplants have proved so
fecal transplants is a big deal.
Poo transplants are really extremely good if there's a deficiency. Yes, please.
Okay. Hi, Paul. One question I did want to ask is, with all of this cancer, you didn't mention anything about diet or any, you know, high amounts of, say, vitamins within that. How does that work?
Just right at the end, I said using diet to... Now, the standard of care for people undergoing chemotherapy is basically to eat well and build up your strength. For people who subscribe to this alternative view, it's the exact opposite. Starvation is what is recommended, or the ketogenic diet, which is basically the Atkins diet. So Tom Seyfried, who's coming to our next workshop, he's a Boston cancer researcher and physician, has written a book, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, and he practices on his students. He gets them to not eat for a week, and they seem perfectly happy. And so, you know, he advocates. The main thing is to cut down the glucose. So sugar is bad. I mean, I think it's bad for diabetes, but it's bad for cancer. The problem is that this whole realm of lifestyle and cancer is a minefield of, you know, folklore and frankly, mumbo-jumbo. And it's really hard to separate out the things that can be taken seriously from just, you know, the latest eating fad.
Dr. Michael Mosley's written a book on this, on the 5x2 diet. He was on the Science Show. Yesterday's on the Science Show again tomorrow. Yes, please, over there.
And some amphibians can regenerate their limbs, particularly salamanders, and it's apparently not easy to derail that process. And I wonder how you might want to.
That's the toughest work, isn't it?
Yes. And this is interesting because I mentioned I gave a sort of precursory opening address at a big conference that preceded funding these 12 centres. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know anything about cancer. What am I going to say? And then I thought, well, where do you see rapid cell proliferation that is apparently well managed? And one is embryogenesis, and the other is the salamander's limbs. And I mentioned both of these, and an oncologist came up to me afterwards, and he said, because I said to this mass audience, hundreds of people, does anybody know anything about, you know, salamander limb regeneration? Blank stares. Guy came up to me afterwards, and he said, well, interesting you mentioned that, because I think there was a paper in the 1930s on this, you see. Anyway, I mentioned the work of Michael Levin at Tufts University. So he's done experiments in which you induce a tumour in the limb of a salamander. So here's a limb, here's a tumour. You cut off the limb through the tumour, and then you think, well, when it regenerates the limb, will it regenerate the tumour? It doesn't. Reprograms the whole thing. So he thinks there's like an inverse correlation between limb regeneration and embryogenesis and wound healing, inverse correlation between that and cancer. Cancer is sometimes described as the wound that never heals. So it's when a process like that goes a bit wrong that you get something like cancer. But the salamanders sort it all out. It's extraordinary.
Yes, please.
Hi, Paul. I work in a modality that helps my clients express repressed emotion. And a doctor called Dr. Arthur Yanov did some work back in the 90s with using a therapy called primal therapy to release gated emotion in cells.
Primal screams.
The primal scream.
I won't
indeed.
Engage him.
Yeah, so the work I do is similar to that, but I'm quite interested in your work, the genie, because it's a similar kind of analogy, and I'm just wondering, is there any of your research on the psychological side as well as on the physical side?
The short answer is no. We're really concentrating on the cancer cell, its microenvironment, and its genetic history. However, let me just reiterate the point that I did refer to a stressed microenvironment. And by what I mean by that, people always leap to the conclusion that means if I'm feeling stressed, I make a stressed microenvironment. Stress, for a physicist, means very definitely you take something, you squash it in a certain way. Those are shear stresses. In biology, stress means that there is one of the many parameters that control how a healthy cell behaves undergoes an excursion of some sort, and it might be a temperature. Heat stress is one that organisms have to cope with a lot. Might be pressure, might be shear stress, whole lot of things like that. That's what I mean by stress. And people say, well, if I'm feeling stress, would it lead to tissue stress? Well, it might and it might not. You know, there are indirect ways. If you flood your body with adrenaline, it's going to change some of the physical properties of your tissues. But there's no obvious and direct correlation.
It is possibly worth reading the work of Elizabeth Blackburn, the last person to get a Nobel Prize, who linked that sort of personal stress to the telomeres in the cells, the DNA. And that's very interesting stuff. She gave a lecture at the town hall here when she was in Adelaide last. It's very interesting stuff. Thank you.
How are we doing?
We've all done.
Cut and run,
4 o'clock. We've made it. Paul.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.